instead of speaking of, it being feeding time, it was, we're serving lunch. And so just a real emphasis on using language to signal respect, that just because you are in prison doesn't mean you lose your humanity.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So really delighted that today's guest is Professor Kimberly Brownlee, who holds the Canada Research Chair in Ethics and Political and Social Philosophy at the University of British Columbia in Canada. Prior to this, Kimberly lived in the UK for close to 20 years and was professor at the University of Warwick and senior lecturer at the University of Manchester. Her work focuses on loneliness, belonging, social human rights, punishment, conscientious belief and civil disobedience. She's the author of two books, Conscience and Conviction, The Case for Civil Disobedience, and Of Being Sure of Each Other, an essay on social rights and freedoms, which I believe is Kimberly's most recent publication. She's engaged with senior management teams in UK prisons who are working to improve the ways they speak and think about the people in their care. Really pleased you could join us today, Kimberly. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Naomi. Thank you, David.
Kimberly, can you tell us something about your career trajectory and how you came to develop special interests in so many areas related to the criminal justice system?
So I grew up in Canada and studied at McGill before coming over to England to study at Cambridge and Oxford, and then got a job and stayed, as Naomi said, for 20 years. And my research interests have centered around what it means to be social, what it means to have a deep belief, and those two ideas intersect. Because in my defense of civil disobedience, I argue that having a deep belief isn't merely a private act. It's willing to be seen, willing to stand up and be seen to defend your view. So my life is my message is the core thought. And so from that initial work on conviction as a social enterprise, I then moved into thinking about other aspects of social life, and specifically social human rights, which tend to be neglected. So in my view, we have a right against social deprivation. We have a right to be protected from inadequate access to decent human contact. So someone who's held in solitary confinement, in my view, that's a human rights violation, even if the person has the monastic training or the military training to withstand those conditions. They are being denied minimally adequate access to decent human contact. The same is true for someone who's held in an ordinary prison in many cases. These can be really brutal environments, and so the person lacks minimally adequate access to decent human contact. That's the key piece. They're missing the decency in their social environment. So with respect to your question of how did I develop an interest in issues related to criminal justice, I think to some extent it's I think we've become very attentive to the needs of people who have various disadvantages, but we have not extended that acknowledgement to people in prison. So people with disabilities, and I am a person with disability, have gained a lot of recognition over the past 20, 30 years, not to be spoken about in certain ways, not to be treated in certain ways. But we're not doing the same for people in prison. And so part of my project has been to try and push against the way we tend to talk about people in prison. We tend to use reductive language. We reduce someone to their offense. So we use essentialist terms. This person is an offender, a criminal, a crook, a felon. They're an ex-con, ex-felon. And then we use more specific terms. This person is a forgive the language, this person is a rapist, a pedophile, a murderer. And we deny this person a rich, full identity. They become just the offense. And so in the same way that we've moved away from essentialist language in other domains, we don't speak of people as being, an inebriate, a degenerate, a lowlife. So too in criminal justice, we shouldn't reduce people to their offenses. And I know a little bit personally about stigma, about being stigmatized. So not only do I have a disability, but I'm partially sighted, but I have a condition known as oculocutaneous albinism. So as a result of that, I have very fair skin, very fair hair, very pale blue eyes. And there is a stigma, it's slowly ebbing away, but there is a stigma around having albinism. The person with albinism is often represented in the movies as the villain, the evil incarnate. And so I have a personal interest in how we represent people and which parts of their lives we take to be definitive of who they are.
Thank you. That's a really excellent answer. Can I just pick up something that Naomi said in her introduction, though? She mentioned that you were engaged with senior management teams in UK prisons, working with them to improve ways they speak and think about the people in their care, which is just the point you were making, I think. So how did you go about that?
So the senior management team at HMP Stafford reached out to me after I published a piece in the online magazine Aeon. And the piece was titled that we should stop calling people who commit offenses criminals. And they were interested in this idea because their citizenship program was a key piece of that program was to change the way they spoke about the people in their care. And historically in that prison, and I'm sure still the case in many prisons in the UK, people in custody are referred to in somewhat derogatory language. So someone is, their role would be the bin man. And so at Stafford, they changed this to the maintenance technician. Someone who previously was the greeter is now an information ambassador. People in prison got to say what form of address they wanted. So whether they want to be addressed by their last name, their first name with Mr. And they also weren't referred to any longer as prisoners. They were residents. Now, there was some disagreements about whether that change to residents was a good change. So, some people felt that actually both people in the care and staff thought this misrepresented their experience. But there was a move, instead of speaking of, it being feeding time, it was, we're serving lunch. And so just a real emphasis on using language to signal respect, that just because you are in prison doesn't mean you lose your humanity, that you're still, worthy of respect, despite having engaged in, a serious wrong.
Yeah, I personally really hate that expression, feeding time, but also talking about shipping people out, because both those expressions to me conjure up cattle, not human beings. And, feel very dehumanising expressions to use, but they're bandied around every day.
Yeah, I think it was something that we had to learn pretty quickly when we started doing these podcasts, although I think Naomi and I are both quite careful about how we refer to people, and Naomi was much better at it than I am, but we quickly encountered people, particularly Americans actually, I think, Naomi, who pointed out that sometimes we were misusing or using the wrong kind of noun to describe people.
Well, and so in my teaching, in teaching criminal justice at Warwick and Manchester, I deliberately changed the language. So I started to refer to people as a person who has committed an offence. For the most part, my students did not follow me in changing their language. But it was it took an effort because much clunkier. It's much easier to use the reductive term, but think I'm not using this reductively. I'm simply referring to a mode of behavior. In the States, under the Obama administration, there was a move to describe people coming out of prison as returning citizens, which is far better than ex-con, ex-felon, but is still imperfect because it implies that they weren't a citizen while in prison. And so there's a related debate about whether someone in prison should have the right to vote. And I don't think you lose your citizenship. There are some rights that should be secure. You may lose your freedom of movement. You may lose many rights that go with having freedom of movement, but you shouldn't lose your standing as a citizen when you're in prison.
So, Kimberly, I recently watched a lecture you gave at Simon Fraser University on civil rights, and it was a tour de force. I was overwhelmed by your capacity to hold an argument in your mind and deliver it. And you gave a very striking illustration. You pointed out that the right to paid holiday was registered as a basic human right, while having access to clean and breathable air was not. So is hope, like air, a necessary feature of meaningful human life?
So I think that's an excellent question, and we do tend to ignore the basics. There's many reasons that the right to breathable air might not be, is not on the enumerated list of human rights. If you look at the Universal Declaration or the International Covenants, you won't find a right to breathable air. One reason might be that at the time those documents were being written, 1948 for the UDHR and then 1960s for the Covenants, this wasn't yet a universal worry that there might not be breathable air. And whether it's a substantial and recurrent threat is one reference point for a human right. Is this something that we need to have legal muscle in place to protect people from breach of this interest? And with respect to hope, it may be true that it's sort of among the basics, and so might be. It might tend to be ignored, just sort of presumed to be there in the background, that people have a capacity for hope, can sustain hope, whatever their conditions. Or it might be sort of a little harder to quantify. How could a government try to honor people's capacity for hope, their need to have hope? Governments are primary duty bearers when it comes to human rights, and so some things we have deep interests in having are viewed as too expensive. Sort of the point of human rights historically was thought to be this is to protect you from oppression, this is to protect you from government interference. You have certain basic civil and political liberties that have to be secured so that government isn't intruding too much. And it's only more recently that we've recognized that actually, first of all, those civil and political liberties are also expensive. The right to vote is expensive. You need a functioning system for that to work. So too, the right to due process, you need an expensive functioning legal apparatus for that to work. But also there's growing recognition that actually human rights are not just about protecting you from oppression or undue interference, they're about ensuring you have a basic minimum. And so that means ensuring you have basic economic welfare rights, a right to be free from poverty, a right to have a shelter and basic subsistence. And Henry Hsieh has argued compellingly in his book, Basic Rights, that shelter and subsistence, these are the most basic. You will not secure your other rights, your civil and political rights, unless these ones are satisfied. And through some of my pressure, he's revised that. He now includes social inclusion amongst that most basic set. He said in a way, this is more basic than basic, to be socially included, certainly as a child, but have the opportunities for social inclusion as an adult. that is necessary to maintain the cognitive competence necessary to exercise other rights. So that, you know, one thing that's true of solitary confinement is it puts excessive pressure on our ability to continue to be social beings. People who've endured it report that this is worse than the most horrific companion. This is worse than any other kind of suffering, that we start to break down mentally and physically when we are forced into isolation.
So thinking about your article, Punishment and Precious Emotions, Kimberly, you discuss five observations about hope. Can you talk us through these?
Sure. So I'll just say a word about how hope came to be a theme I wanted to explore. And it started off with the case in the UK of Katie Allen, who is a 21-year-old student at the University of Glasgow. And in 2018, she was sentenced to prison for 16 months because she had hit a teenager while she was driving drunk. But 3 months into her prison sentence, she took her own life in Polmont Prison. That was in June 2018. And her parents, Linda and Stuart Allen, they said that she had been bullied by other inmates in the prison, that she had been repeatedly strip searched by staff, and that staff had ignored the fact she was vulnerable. And so after she took her own life, her parents did some research on how often suicide happens in Scottish prisons. And according to the BBC, their research showed that over the past 10 years, 40% of deaths in custody were suicides. And indeed, 32 of the 82 people who took their own life in prison over the last 10 years, 32 of those people were under the age of 30. And so her parents said, we shouldn't ignore this. This is the stark reality in Scottish prisons, that it is actually a disproportionately high number of young people who are taking their life in prison. And and they said, if someone breaks the law and they get punished and a custodial sentence is part of that punishment, so be it. But they said, we don't have the death penalty in Scotland, and a person shouldn't pay for their crimes with their life. And so it was that story, that very heart-wrenching story, that pushed me to think about hope, the place of hope in punishment. And so, as a philosopher, one of the main activities I engage in is conceptual analysis. And so I started poking at this concept of hope. What does it mean to have hope, to retain your hope? And there's lots of disagreement amongst philosophers about what the essence of hope is. But the five ideas about hope, or the five observations that I offer in the paper, they start with the thought that hope is more than a mere preference for something. Hope, when we hope for something, we have skin in the game. We are invested. We are eager. We are vulnerable. And also, I was struck looking at the psychology on hope to see that it's often represented as something that comes up in dire conditions. So this is the second thought. So the social psychologist Barbara Fredrickson, she says, if you look at the range of emotions that signal positivity, joy and so on, the one that comes into play when your circumstances are dire is hope. And so she thinks that actually, when things are going well for you, you don't really have a need for hope. Hope arises when you're close to despair. And so she gives a range of examples. You've failed a test. You lost a loved one. You've lost your job. You discover you have cancer. That is, in those desperate situations, that is when you need hope. Now, my second observation about hope was that actually she's overstating things there, Fredrickson, because you can actually hope in positive settings too. So, Barack Obama used hope as a key concept in his first election campaign. And, and he wasn't meaning to imply that conditions were dire in America, but that, nonetheless, sort of, yes, we can, yes, we can triumph, we can make things better. So too, you know, you can hope for your sports team to win. The chance of winning doesn't have to be negligible for you to hope that they will win. You can hope your baby that you're expecting will be a boy or a girl. You know, that doesn't have to have a context of dire circumstances in the background. So that's the second observation. The third is that we tend to think of hope as looking toward the future. You know, I hope things will get better. I hope things will change. I hope this will work out. But I think hope can actually be both past-oriented and present-oriented, not just future-oriented. So with respect to past-oriented, I could hope that my friend didn't suffer when he passed away. In terms of present-oriented hope, I can hope that things continue to go as well as they are going in a relationship. So I think hope is actually fairly flexible and dexterous. It can arise in a lot of different contexts. But in terms of punishment, the points that are most interesting are the fourth and fifth one I explore. And so one is that we can hope for things that are highly unlikely to occur. So the example I give in the paper is Tukey Williams, who was a gang leader in the United States in the late 1970s, and who was given a life sentence, a capital punishment, was given a death sentence for four murders that took place in the late 1970s. And for the first decade or so that he was in prison, he continued to lead a gangster life. But in the 1990s, he became he changed his perspective and became an anti-gang activist. He wrote a number of children's books against gang life, and he became a model, sort of an image of someone who was worthy of redemption. And he actually received a President's Call to Service Award from George W. Bush. He hoped that his sentence would be commuted, but then Governor Schwarzenegger did not give him a reprieve, and he was one of the last people to be executed in California in 2005. Prior to that, he was interviewed by a journalist for The Guardian, who asked him, how do you keep going? And he said in Latin, "Dum spiro spero," while I breathe, I hope. And he learned to read Latin in prison and changed his outlook in prison. But he did not give prison any credit for that change in perspective. He did not find his conditions conducive to change. The final point about hope that I make is that we can, perhaps especially if conditions are dire, we can hope for things that aren't worth hoping for, or we can hope for a terrible option that to us seems to be the lesser of two evils. So you might actually hope for death in order to finish your suffering if you can't stand the conditions you're in. So the takeaway of the observations I offer in the paper is that hope is a very complex concept, that it is dexterous and flexible and can apply in many different ways and can be used sometimes productively, sometimes unproductively. It's a bit of a rational irrationality, depending on what we're hoping for and why we're hoping. But then when it comes to prison, I offer what I call a hope standard, which uses a tighter specification of hope. And that is that for a punishment to be morally justifiable, it has to enable a reasonable person to retain hope, not only about their conditions during their punishment, but also hope for their future life after punishment, that they have to have a life to hope for, a life worth living to hope for after punishment. And that when we embrace that, we actually, it puts a lot of restrictions on the kinds of punishments we can use.
It sounds like a fairly high bar when I think of our prisons. And while you're talking, Kimberly, it reminds me that in Britain, as I'm sure you know, we have a number of men, mainly men, in prison on indeterminate public protection sentences where one element of the punishment appears to be hope dashed. Yeah. What do you think about
that?
Yeah,
so in the UK, the UK claims various things on behalf of its system, which I don't think it's entitled to claim. One is with respect to the use of solitary confinement. The UK claims not to use solitary confinement because it lines up with what the Special Rapporteur on Torture said was the maximum time frame, and you could segregate someone. So they and that, according to the Special Rapporteur, is 2 weeks. Anything beyond that is torture, and the UK claims not to hold someone in segregation for longer than 2 weeks. I've asked psychologists about that number, that 2 week number, and have been saying, that's a political number. That's not a research informed number. That 24 hours can become stressful. 3 days can begin to feel torturous. That it's the UK shouldn't be claiming this, that they're not engaging in extreme practices when they use segregation in this way. With respect to hope dashed and the idea of being given a whole life order, in the UK, if you're given a whole life order, you can only be given release on compassionate grounds, and so this is this leads to an issue that the European Court on Human Rights has grappled with as to whether life imprisonment or a whole life order can be compatible with a person retaining hope. The idea that someone has a right to hope, and that hope is it's a part of human dignity that you be able to retain your right to hope. And so in a case that came before the court, Vinter and others versus the UK, the court explored this idea of human dignity and argued that there had to always be the prospect for release, that was necessary for hope. Even so, the European Court of Human Rights mistakenly, in my view, accepted as sufficient the fact you could only get release on compassionate grounds. So if you were terminally ill or if you, through tragic family circumstances, then you had the prospect for release. So that's a very narrow set of conditions under which you could hope to be released from a whole life order. And so, yes, I would say that hope dashed, a violation of the right to hope is very much a part of the UK approach to whole life orders.
Well, you can see quite clearly that has an impact on an individual when they have the hope removed from them in that way. But does that have an implication for wider society? What does that say about us as a society that we're prepared to compromise on something like hope?
So I think our legal system, our modes of punishment, not only does it reflect our society, reflect the things our society is willing to have our legislators enact on our behalf, but it also can shape our society, can shape our attitudes toward people. And so, in a way, it's not surprising that reductivist language, offender, murderer, that continues to be used, because there's a cycle, there's a circle between the modes of punishment that we use and the way we are going to think about people who are at the receiving end of those modes of punishment. What's very interesting, though, is that studies on rehabilitation and desistance show that this is counterproductive, that we are not actually going to reduce recidivism rates unless we start to adopt a more humane view of people who have offended. So there's a report in the UK 3-4 years ago on transforming rehabilitation, which referenced research that has shown that if a person's allowed to think of themselves as basically decent, but having made a mistake, that then they are less likely to reoffend. If a person's allowed to maintain contact with their family, close contact, then that non-criminogenic community can help them to see themselves as something other than their offense. Because the problem with a lot of our punishment practices is we give a person a choice. You know, when you're sent to prison, you can either reject this identity. You know, this you are a criminal. This is your defining feature. This horrible act. In which case, if you reject that, you'll really struggle to achieve parole because you're not walking the walk or talking the talk in terms of what they're expecting to see. Or you can embrace this identity. You know, yes, I am nothing but this offense. Yes, I am a criminal. In which case, very hard to achieve redemption and to desist because you've identified with this horrible act. So I think we need to rethink many aspects of how we punish. I find, in contrast to Anglo-American systems, some approaches in Scandinavia are very interesting. So in Norway, they use weekend prisons. So a person will be at home with family, maintaining their employment throughout the week, and then they'll go to prison on Friday, and they'll be there over the weekend, and then go back again. And so, this obviously you're not using prison to incapacitate, to sort of protect a wider society from this person. They're not deemed to be a threat, but you're still using some form of hard treatment. You're still communicating condemnation of their act, but in a way that doesn't sever their social bonds, deny them work, make it very difficult for them to reestablish themselves afterward.
It seems like that's the system itself is more hopeful than the British and American system, doesn't it? Because the way we treat people, it implies there is no real redemption for them, whereas the Scandinavian system seems to have some sense of hope on behalf of the person, as well as perhaps enabling hope to flourish in the individual who's imprisoned.
So I think it comes down to trust, that hope is linked to trust, because it is in a way our societal hope that would seem to be lacking in the UK and America and to some extent Canada as well, that the thought that we must be fearful, forever fearful of someone who's committed a serious offence, that they have to wear this letter on their chest for the rest of their life. It sometimes a person's given a record they can never spend. They will always have to declare it on applications for work or requests for a visa, that this this will follow them everywhere. And so your studies on Scandinavian countries show there are a lot higher levels of trust, and that to some extent can be traced to more equitable arrangements, that less poverty, higher levels of education, generally smaller gaps between the wealthy and the less wealthy, and so I would guess to really take care of our criminal justice system and attend to how we view people who offend, there's many other things we'd have to focus on. How many people are living in poverty? What conditions are people forced to grow up in? And how does that ripple out into a general societal distrust?
Thank you. Are there any times when being hopeful might be unhelpful? Because I was just thinking then about sometimes people are hopeful and might underestimate risk, for instance. I suppose that's the fear, is that too much hope is a misplaced optimism. But I also wonder whether there might be times when being hopeful might be unhelpful for an individual.
Yeah, so ultimately, I take the view that hope is necessary for a good life. It's necessary for us to have meaning in our lives, that actually it helps to orient our agency. It's part of it's a trigger for planning, a trigger for investment and for optimism and commitment to try to change, try to improve, to look forward to better days. But it is an interesting question, specifically in prison, whether having hope could make your condition worse. So this, if you think of Tukey Williams again, that while I breathe, I hope, to know that that Governor Schwarzenegger was not going to commute his sentence, how much harder, how much more devastating was that news because he had dared to hope. And that perhaps in prison, certainly if you've been given a whole life order, your life will be somewhat easier, in quotes, if you can be resigned to your situation, if you don't have any wish to alter what comes your way. So it may perhaps be a mark of courage to be able to live in prison without hope. That said, it's a pretty bleak existence that someone is then living, you know, to live without planning, live without a full sense of agency, live without any goal or orientation toward, you know, seeing family again or living in a different way. And, you know, so it's at odds with how most of us make sense of our lives and find meaning. You know, we find meaning through, you know, either the richness of our present conditions, which is very hard in prison, or from, you know, aiming toward a future that we have shaped, that we are in control of. So it's I don't think hope could be, you know, be a vice. And, you know, in the paper I flirt with that thought that Mr. Wilkins Micawber in Charles Dickens' David Copperfield, who says, you know, something will turn up, his go-to phrase, something will turn up. Sort of relentlessly optimistic, relentlessly hopeful, you know, annoyingly hopeful, gullible, and so on. But sort of putting that caricature aside, hope is part of what makes life meaningful.
Well, I was thinking about sometimes when people's hope might blind them to the reality of a situation. So, for instance, when somebody spends a long time stating that they're innocent when they first get to prison, mm-hmm. in the hope that they somehow their situation will be reversed, and then eventually at some point they then stop talking about their offending in a more open way. And also, I suppose I was thinking back about David's question about people on indeterminate public protection audit sentences, where it seems there that there's almost an inversion. So it seems often when people who've received a life sentence come to prison, there's a loss of hope, and then incrementally it seems to grow as they can see themselves progressing. Whereas I suppose my experience of people on IPPs is often that they arrive in prison and there's a kind of naive hopefulness that they've got very short tariff, so they'll be back out in society very quickly, and then that becomes dashed because actually that's not the reality of the situation. People are expecting to see action to be taken so that they can demonstrate a reduction in risk, and their hope seems to shrink and shrink and shrink. I don't know.
Yeah. So that's very interesting. It's one of the objections against a rehabilitative justification for punishment is that it sometimes licenses indeterminacy, you know, an indefinite sentence, you know, sort of in the name of rehabilitation. And someone who defends, you know, desert justification for punishment will say, well, you know, there's only a limited amount of time you can hold a person. It has to be, it has to line up with the severity of their punishment. And so I think one productive, practical payoff of adopting a hope standard would be to say, well, actually, this puts a rehabilitative check on a rehabilitative strategy that allows for indeterminacy and indefinite punishment. Because in order for a person to retain hope for a future after punishment, that future has to be within view in some sense. They have to have some prospect, some sort of, you know, set of steps in the clear timeline for release in order to maintain hope for that future. So I think we can do a lot of additional, you know, incidental or indirect harm and wrong to people in custody by, you know, sort of putting them in this vague twilight zone, sort of this space of uncertainty where they don't know when they'll be released and, you know, and they don't know to some extent, you know, what they have to do in order to secure release, especially if it requires a lack of authenticity, sort of embracing an identity they don't have good reason to identify with. I think on, you know, on death row, it can also, you know, although in a way there's a sort of a determinate end, it can also have that same twilight zone feel, because many of the administrators who oversee the process of capital punishment deliberately go slowly. The secretary will only stamp one piece of paper a day. They try and hold things up, not to rush someone's punishment. But I don't know, to be left in that limbo, sort of waiting for this seemingly determinate end that never comes. Many people spend over a decade on death row. It seems to be a horrible condition, sort of waiting for death, but never knowing when it's going to come. Mm.
Yeah, certainly seems very torturous, doesn't it? Yep. And I've spent a lot of time delving, I realised, reading your paper, spent a lot of time delving in darker emotions, like things like shame, for instance. And that made me wonder if there are any ways we can effectively measure hope and the hopefulness of an individual.
So I think that's a really interesting question, and it's not one I gave enough space to thinking about this topic, is how... what might be specific behavioral markers of hope, or what concrete strategies might we use to help someone recover their hope if it has been dashed? And I'm guessing some of the behavioral markers, sort of ways to gauge someone's level of hope, would be, is this person engaging in planning? Is this person anticipating or sort of using their agency to try and work towards something productive? Do they look forward to the family visits? Are they participating in the prison choir? What level of activity is there to show this person's displaying their agency? In terms of helping someone to recover hope, I think I would need to ask some social psychologists, whether once hope is dashed, hope is lost, whether it can be recovered. One of the I referenced a poem in the piece by Emily Dickinson, where she suggests that sort of hope is always there. I'll just read the poem. She says, "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash that little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, but never in extremity it asked a crumb of me." And she's not the only poet who suggests that hope springs eternal. Hope never stops. But I think hope can stop, absolutely can stop, and that some of the ways we practice punishment seems to be deliberately aimed at robbing someone of their hope. And it's hard, apart from sort of tapping into ancient instinctual delight in revenge, it's hard to know what the value could possibly be. And I don't think that is a value, delighting in revenge. But why on earth we think that's productive?
Yeah, it almost seems like it's easier to get away with, isn't it? Because it's less tangible. You can't torture people because people are looking out for those kind of things. But actually, if you deprive them of hope, there's a cruelty to that. And as you were talking, I was thinking about whether people engage it in their sentence plans as part of the evaluation of hope. Because that's all. Whenever I've heard that mentioned, it's always been used in a very judgmental way about the individual. They're being non-compliant. They're not engaging in their sentence planning. It's as if they're being willfully uncooperative and destructive, rather than actually what it might be is it might be reflective of something that's more depressed. The lack of hope. What's the point in participating in my sentence plan? Because I have such little control over where my life's going.
Right. No, that's very interesting. So yes, no, it would seem that if senior management teams actually are wanting buy-in, that they have to be willing to relinquish a bit of control. One thing that I've flagged to the prison wardens I've spoken to is family visits, friend visits, that should not be a privilege that can be withheld. But it is used as the carrot and the stick. You get on board with what we require, or you'll be denied the next family visit. And so what, you know, when sort of the most precious things are used against you, used to get you back in line, you know, the stick over your head, it's very hard to have a sense of agency. So not surprising if someone becomes depressed. When I've visited prisons, I think the one impression, one thing that struck me was passivity is the wrong word, but the sense that the people I spoke with were sort of entirely available, that, you know, the our encounter was entirely on my terms. You know, even if I'd interrupted them in work they were engaging in, that they wouldn't signal in any way that they wanted to get back to their task, that they were, you know, sort of, it was entirely for me to say when our conversation ended or where the conversation went. And so that kind of passivity is not conducive with reestablishing yourself afterward, because, you know, once you're sent out of prison, you know, you have to try and reintegrate. And many, you know, several prison wardens have said to me that, you know, when they say goodbye to someone and send them out the door, they know in most cases this person's going to be back. And to some extent, it's because they've become institutionalized. They've been forced to acclimatize to this environment, an environment that often does rob you of your agency.
And thinking about hope standards, you know, how would that alter how we treat people on release, do you think?
I've spoken to some people who work with the NGOs that try to support prisoners on release, and they say that sometimes a person is sent out of prison and they're not given a map. They're not told where the local train station is or the local bus station. And sometimes, you know, many people in the UK are held in national hubs. Held in prisons far away from, you know, where they committed their offense, where they grew up, where they might think, you know, that's their community. And so, you know, to try to get back there, you need to know where you are. And so to deny someone a map seems a striking, unnecessary imposition of a vulnerability. About one third of people expect to be homeless the night they leave prison in the UK. And in Australia, it's slightly higher. And so for someone not to be offered any provision, any transition, any guarantee by the prison staff, this is where you're going to go, and these people will take you in, this is, you can stay here for these many nights and so on, that's really sort of, dropping someone. And it's setting up the next set of struggles, that someone will have to find some people who will accept them initially, or, they're going to be back at square one. And many people have to survive on about £50 for more than 2 weeks until their welfare kicks in, and so you use that, toward the train, you're trying to get home, and so these are not good conditions in which to set up hope for a future after punishment or to reduce recidivism rates. You have to invest in the use post bellum, sort of after the time is done, what's the next step? Don't forget the end game, I think, is the key thing. And I've suggested to senior management teams that they have something equivalent to an alumni scheme. So if in fact this is the only community where you're not judged for how you've behaved and who you are, that being able to maintain some contact with that community, but in a different way that doesn't sort of pull you back in, but nonetheless you haven't had the link severed, that might be some way of helping with the transition back into society.
Thank you.
When I was at working at HMP Grandon, we used to talk about having a sort of, we may have used the word academy, but alumni scheme is another way of describing it. And I think they do to some extent. They keep in contact with a lot of guys who have moved on, and they often go back for conferences and meetings and so on. But it could be developed much more. So it's kind of easy to understand why emotions like fear and disgust aren't easily spoken about. But why do you think hope is so badly neglected as an emotion when it comes to the justice system? I mean, does this reflect something in the wider society, resentment or neglect?
I think it's partly to do with vulnerability, that hope, because it signals investment, eagerness, vulnerability, that, on the face of it, it might not seem to have a place in criminal justice or punishment. Punishment is the imposition of a hard treatment on a person in response to an offense. It's the decision to use that strategy rather than other strategies to deal with big problems. So there are competing ways to deal with wrongdoing. We don't have to punish. We can sometimes think of punishment as a natural phenomenon. It couldn't but be there. But just as we don't have to have a military, we don't have to have a criminal justice system, or we certainly don't have to have prison or worse, capital punishment, as they do in the U.S. And one story I read about a community, and so I'll offer this as a bit apocryphal because I couldn't find a corroborating reference for it, but it was a story of a tribe, the Bembe tribe, that when someone committed a serious offense, all work would stop in the community, and everyone would come together and form a circle around the person, and then each member of the community would take some time to describe the person in the middle, their good qualities, sort of moments where they'd been kind, moments where they had helped others, moments where they, sort of showed the best of the human spirit. And this process would go on for days if necessary. And then at the end, the circle would break up and there would be a celebration and the person would be reintegrated. And so we might from the outside think, well, this was an act of public shaming. But the way it's presented, it's meant to be purely restorative. It's meant to redraw the connections, remind this person that they are basically good, sort of heal and soothe, not to burden and censure and condemn and dehumanize. I think we have a tendency in Western societies, in our interpersonal relationships too, to turn away, to shun, to censure, rather than to reinvest. It's a parenting strategy to use time outs. Your child is denied contact until they figure out how to behave. In Western prisons, the idea of solitary confinement was meant originally to be, sort of a contemplative state of reflection, a bit like the monk. You go into solitude and you reflect on your wrong and you come to appreciate how you what you need to do by way of remedy and why what you did was wrong, and then you sort of try to reestablish yourself. But the reality is that isolating, severing, separating, shunning, exiling, ostracizing, these are brutal practices that our brains register these as equally painful to physical injury. And it's actually the same parts of the brain, the same neural pathways, which register physical pain, that register social pain. And that we can remember being ostracized and shut out as a worse experience than being bullied. At the time, each experience might feel equally bad, but we'll remember the ostracism much longer and much more intensely later. So I think there's sort of multiple intersecting threads, but there's... at the heart of it is really how do we want to view people, and how willing are we to reinvest rather than to do what's quick and dirty, quick and easy, which is to shut them out.
Thank you. So in the paper we were talking about earlier, you advance four arguments for a hope standard for punishment. Can you talk us through those?
So the first argument is the one that I've sort of flagged a little bit, that hope is deeply valuable, that hope is part of our agency, it's part of our autonomy, it's part of a meaningful life to have hope, and so rights, human rights, they are meant to track fundamental human interests, so the right to life and right to health and all the civil and political rights I listed, these are meant to protect what is most fundamentally important to us. And so if the social psychology story and the theoretical story about the inherent value of hope is credible, then we're in the business of defending a right to hope. The second argument I offer is related to something we've discussed already, and that is how we view people, whether we should view someone as beyond the pale or as always having the potential for redemption. And I argue that we should always view people as being potentially redeemable, that is part of viewing a person as a person. If we say a person is beyond the pale, we're essentially saying this person's no longer human. This person is a beast, is a creature. They might have sort of a non-human animal existence, but not a human life. And that's an incredibly stark and I think incorrect way of viewing, of thinking about people. And Andrew Ashworth and Lucia Zedner, two very influential legal scholars, they reflect on that thought in their discussion of the right to hope. And they say that a commitment to hope requires acknowledging a person's capacity for moral choice. And so when a criminal sentence deems someone to be so dangerous that they're no longer an agent, we essentially deny them the possibility of being assessed as able to change. And so they say, we have to look at our punishment practices and ensure that our risk management programs and our rehabilitative programs are functioning well in prison, that they're accessible and they're adequate, so that we don't deny people hope and deny them essentially the capacity for moral choice. So viewing someone as redemption, as redeemable, isn't just an attitude. It takes positive decisions. It takes investment in the system to walk the walk that we believe someone is redeemable. The third argument relates to the conditions for taking human rights seriously. So it's not just that there would seem to be a human right to hope because of a fundamental interest in hope, but also that human rights is a practice. It's sort of a legally entrenched practice, but also a moral practice. And in order for this moral practice to work, we have to have certain conditions of reciprocity be met. And so reciprocity means viewing each other in a certain way. Human rights, most human rights require exercise. You have to exercise your right to vote, your right to stand for office, your right to due process. These are things your right to practice your religion, or these are things you require cognitive competence to do. And so if we put someone in conditions that start to erode or even eliminate that cognitive competence, then we are denying someone the standards of reciprocity necessary to exercise human rights. So we're retaining the capacities for human rights puts strict limits on the kinds of punishment we can use, sort of potentially hope-denying punishments. And then the fourth argument, which we've also discussed a little bit, is the fourth argument is strategic, and that is, as a society, it's in our interests to adopt a hope standard. If we're genuinely interested in rehabilitation and desistance, we have a responsibility to view people who have offended as redeemable, as potentially sort of reestablishing themselves fully in the community, as worthy of respect. And that last argument is very much a consequentialist one. We will fare better as a society if we take a less vengeful, less punitive approach.
Well, certainly, if you think about the human need to belong, we as human beings, we need physically to belong in order to live, don't we? And whilst we might be able to manage to do that without social connections, we know that people who are lonely fare worse, and yet that all seems to be able to be taken away from people when we write them off and say they're irredeemable, which is what we're effectively doing with the whole life tariff, aren't we? So it seems like we're trampling on human rights in all sorts of
in all sorts of ways. And it's, I suppose, there's that question again of, you know, you either believe in something or you don't. And if you believe in human rights, those human rights have to apply to everyone, even if it takes more, you have to dig deeper to value the human rights for some individuals because of the acts that they've taken. You know, there's a moral conflict, isn't there?
Right. Well, and I think when we're, you know, when we have sort of a knee-jerk, angry reaction to someone who's behaved egregiously, we can really dig into the idea, well, they have forfeited their rights. They, you know, they've done this horrific thing. This, you know, they've lost their standing. They, you know, but we don't think that. You know, we don't think someone becomes fair game. You know, once they've committed an offense, we don't think all rights are lost. You know, it's not permissible to. You know, we don't actually embrace lex talionis. Lex talionis. You don't do to the person exactly what was done to them. You know, historically, you know, we're more inclined to use corporeal punishment or to approximate lex talionis. But you know, there's many things we cannot do. You know, that you'd be, you know, to deny someone air in prison, or to feed them, you know, deliberately feed them contaminated food, or to torture them. You know, these are things we would never be justified in doing to someone, even if we think they've forfeited some of their rights. You don't lose all of your rights. And the rights that you know, are grounded in the need to belong, those ones really deserve more attention than they've received so far. With respect to what you're saying about loneliness, you know, the UK is sort of until other priorities, including the pandemic, ironically took over, loneliness was getting a lot of attention in the UK. I mean, I say it's ironic because, you know, in the context of the pandemic, you know, so many more people were feeling the horrors of loneliness. Loneliness has been described by some psychologists as worse for your health than smoking 15 cigarettes a day. That, you know, it's correlated with numerous health risks, reduced immunity, progression of Alzheimer's disease, depression, suicidal ideation, suicidal behavior. You know, there's alcoholism. There's a host of health risks that go with feeling chronically lonely. And loneliness is becoming, you know, better researched, but I'm not aware of any longitudinal study on the experience of loneliness in prison. You know, that we sort of put it all into the package of the burdens you must bear when you go into prison, that one of them will probably be feeling deeply socially isolated. But to the extent we take fundamental human interests seriously and the rights they give rise to seriously, we need to be paying attention to the impact of social isolation on people's interests.
Thank you very much, Kimberly. So I can't help thinking that although we focused on hope today, in order to think about hope, you must also be considering all those darker areas of the mind and of social activity. So how do you keep yourself hopeful in the face of this kind of really quite challenging work?
That's a nice question, because it makes me wonder if the sort of the rational irrationality, you know, how much of that is at the root of optimism, that you sort of you commit and you keep committing again and again. I think as a philosopher, I'm fairly lucky. I'm incredibly lucky. I get to sit in an armchair and I get to think about these issues. And you know, someone working in a prison, someone living in a prison, you know, that's the real, those are the really tough conditions in which to retain hope. Because, you know, even if you are naturally inclined to, or you, you know, sort of, you know, really make a commitment, you're bumping into institutional barriers. You're bumping into people's life experiences. One thing that I found very striking reading about prison statistics in the UK is that someone in prison is not at all representative of the general population. That if you find yourself in prison, you are much more likely to have led a really tough life, you know, to have witnessed abuse as a child, to have been a victim of abuse, to have used class A drugs, to have dropped out of school, to be linked to a gang, to have mental health problems. And that's, you know, that's not the typical profile of the general population. So, you know, not only is someone in prison put in a really, really tough environment usually, but they have a backstory that makes it all the harder to come into that setting with hope. And so I think the people who can work in prison and live in prison and keep their hope, those are the impressive people. The philosopher only imagines those conditions.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed that conversation with Kimberly, and I found it really thought-provoking. It made me think about how much we rely on hope being an implicit objective of therapy, when if you think about how much time we spend thinking about hopelessness in terms of things like self-harm and suicide risk, for instance, we in some ways we kind of take it for granted that hope's what we're instilling via the therapeutic process. And it does make me wonder whether, you know, we should be thinking more about assessing hope, not just the hopelessness, in terms of thinking about therapeutic outcomes.
Yes, hope is a very difficult thing to teach, isn't it? It has to be nurtured and developed and to kind of grow according to its environment. I was earlier on, I was listening to Kimberly on a kind of snippet from Newsnight, which she recorded just over a year ago, I suppose, just at the beginning of the pandemic. And it was a very interesting little conversation she and a couple of other people were having. And it really kind of emphasised for me the kind of skill of her philosopher mind in being able to articulate ideas and put them across so very clearly. And in the conversation with us, I thought the way that she described the importance of words and the way that we speak about people, which of course is something that we've talked about together from time to time, and I thought she really highlighted that terribly well. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.